Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Eade, Judge Slater, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Akilah Eade presiding.
Morning. Please be seated. Today is May 7th, 2025. We're here in courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. My name is Kayla Eade. I am serving as presiding judge today. I'm joined here by Judge Slater on my right and Judge Kirk on my left. This is being recorded. The audio recording will be on our website, usually in about 24 hours or less. That is the only recording that's to be made of this proceeding. There is a live stream of it that is on the internet right now. In case you aren't familiar, there is a switch on the front of that podium that you can use to raise or lower it to your comfort level. When you start your argument, counsel, if you could please state your name and who you are representing. In addition, the counsel for the relator will have 15 minutes for their initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. Whenever you're ready, counsel for relator, please proceed. And I should call the case first. This is A241532 in the matter of the calculation of MSRS General Employees Retirement Plan Annuity for Francisco Henderson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Catherine McKinnon, and I represent relator Francisco Pancho Henderson, a longtime employee of the Met Council and a participant in the MSRS General Employees Retirement Plan. This case concerns whether a $160,000 settlement payment that was made by the Met Council to Mr. Henderson was salary, as that is defined in the 2022 version of MnStat 35201 subdivision 13, which for the benefit of the court is set out in full on page 26 of relator's brief. The MSRS board concluded that none of the money was salary under that definition, and as a result, the amount of Mr. Henderson's pension benefit went down because it was not included in his average high five. We believe that the MSRS board's decision was wrong for three reasons. First, the settlement agreement unambiguously designated the payment to be for past lost wages, which would be salary. As such, the settlement agreement itself should have been dispositive and avoided this entire legal proceeding.
Counsel, though, if that's the case, wouldn't there have been a corresponding payment by the employer to the pension fund?
The employer did not make a pension contribution because...
Nor did your client, apparently, right?
Right. Well, he wouldn't have made it because it would have been deducted from the 160. That, in fact, is how this all came about when he saw his actual W-2 and what was contributed. There was no deduction made for MSRS pension contributions from him, so would have reduced the amount of the total amount paid to him. And then he went...
But doesn't that suggest it wasn't salary if there was no deduction?
Well, that's, of course, for the executive director of the MSRS to determine. Ultimately, the whole case is about, that is what the case is about. Was it salary or not? And the employer, Met Council, took the position from the point it issued its payment that this was not pensionable earnings, which is really sort of the shorthand for what this is, pensionable earnings. Mm-hmm. And that is what has raised this entire dispute. Why don't I get first to the question of...
What in the agreement, the phrase
where after it describes the total settlement of $192,000 and electronic payment in the amount of $160,000 to Henderson reflecting alleged wage loss. What's the importance, do you believe, of the word alleged?
I believe it has no significance. It's very common in a settlement agreement to say that's what was alleged. They had not been proven yet, right? This is a settlement. In fact, it's a very early settlement. And it is very common for employers in particular to want the language alleged. But interestingly, that language was actually not in the employer's first draft, the template that the employer submitted. It was language that was offered up by Mr. Firth, the attorney for Mr. Henderson, because, and he testified, well, it's because it's alleged, because it's not happened, it's not been proven, and employers always want the word alleged. I think it's for the same reason that in settlement agreements, employers always want the clause that says, this does not mean that we are admitting we've done anything wrong. It's a settlement agreement, so it's alleged. And that's why the word alleged is in there, but it has no importance as to what it was. It's wage loss damages, which is the language that we have to look at and focus on here. And it should have been focused on by the MSRS, and it should have been focused on by the ALJ, but it wasn't. It is the first duty when interpreting a contract to determine, is that contract ambiguous as a matter of law? That is a legal question. And nobody in this proceeding looked at that.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
There's no dispute that Subdivision 13C of Minnesota Statute Section 352.01 is whether or not it's ambiguous, right? I mean, everyone agrees as to the meaning of that subdivision with regard to a review by the executive director to determine that a settlement is salary?
There is no question that the statutory language is not ambiguous, or is unambiguous.
So, right. And there's no question that we're talking about a legal settlement here, right?
Correct.
So for the settlement to be salary, everyone agrees that the executive director had to review it and make a determination that the amount is consistent with paragraph A of subdivision 13, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Can you explain to me how that interacts with your argument as to the language of the settlement agreement itself?
So the person who initially reviewed this at the MSRS office, Carol Stewart, said when she saw the language, wage loss, or the phrase, I should say, wage loss damages, she was confused, and she didn't think that it described past wage losses. And so what did she do? And presumably she's acting as designee at that point for the executive director. She calls the Met Council and says, What does this mean? And the Met Council says, well, it was someone in the payroll department, tells her, well, it's our understanding that this was supposed to be front pay. Okay, so her default in making this determination of whether this meets the definition of salary is simply, I call the Met Council. Meanwhile, Mr. Henderson submits the settlement language and says, it says right here, it's payment for wage loss damages, and that's past wages or past salary. And in the face of this contradiction between what Mr. Henderson said it was supposed to be and what the settlement agreement says, and what is, in contrast, what the Met Council says, Ms. Stewart simply says, well, it's what the Met Council says. And I cross-examined her on this, and I said, well, why do you just rely on what the employer said? Why do you just default to whatever the employer said? And she basically answered, that's what I default to. We always take what the employer says, because the employer is the one that's paying the money. Now,
I guess the reason why I asked the question is that it seems like the focus of your argument is on whether the settlement agreement is ambiguous, but the second part of the board's decision is that there is no sufficient evidence in the record that the settlement was reviewed and determined by MSRS executive director to be consistent with paragraph A of 35201 subdivision 13 and prior determinations. And it seems like that second part of the board's decision, it could be considered controlling under the statute, because the statute says unless the executive director makes that determination, it's not salary.
Well, the executive director then did in this case. So first, Carol Stewart makes the determination, and she says it's because that's what the Met Council says, it's front pay. Then the executive director did make a decision. Erin Leonard made a decision. I think the letter is March 30th. And she says this was front pay because a payroll employee at the Met Council said it was front pay. That was her determination. Then it went up to the MSRS board, but then they sent it over to the ALJ for a fact-finding hearing.
But what I'm really driving at is you know, are we really reviewing here the board's decision that there's no sufficient evidence in the record that the settlement was reviewed and determined by the executive director to be consistent with paragraph A? Isn't that really what we're reviewing?
You're reviewing two things. You are first reviewing whether they made an error of law, meaning the MSRS board and also the ALJ, in refusing or not looking first at the question of whether the language was ambiguous as a matter of law. This is basic contract law, basic settlement agreement contract law. First, you look at the language. Is the language unambiguous on its face?
But didn't the board do that? I'm just looking at the memo. The board finds the settlement agreement ambiguous.
Kind of, yes, they did it then. But what they should have done is first decided that, then looked at the question of the whether there was sufficient evidence. But let me get back to the first point. Even if they, obviously, they apparently decided that it was ambiguous, but the point is that's wrong as a matter of law, right? And this court can reverse a determination of the MSRS board that is contrary to the law. So we have to start with, was that settlement agreement ambiguous? Because if it was, it's ambiguous as a matter of law, and we should never have gotten into this muddle.
But my question is, even if we agree that the board got it wrong as to whether the settlement was ambiguous, if the board got it right that there was no sufficient evidence in the record that the settlement was reviewed and determined by the executive director to be consistent with paragraph A of 35201 subdivision 13, by definition under the statute, isn't this legal settlement that everyone agrees 13C is not ambiguous. Everyone agrees this is a settlement. And if 13C says a settlement that the executive director doesn't determine is consistent with A isn't salary, how do you win under that scenario?
Well, then neither of us should win. Then it probably should be remanded because they didn't do it.
But the board determined that there was no sufficient evidence in the record to show that, I mean, the exception to, there's an exception definition in 13C. It's presumed that a legal settlement is not salary unless the executive director makes that determination, right?
Right.
So aren't we reviewing the board's determination that that didn't happen, that the exception didn't apply?
In the alternative, because the executive director should have determined that a document was clear on its face, and there was no need for all of this, what was the evidence and what proved intent. The evidence of intent should never have been at issue here. It was clear on its face as a matter of law.
Can I ask the same question? Because I have a similar, I'm not sure yet you've answered Judge Eade's question, but I'm going to pose it just a little bit differently. Even if we agree under this mechanism, the process that has to take place, anytime there's a settlement of this sort and money, and there's a presumption that it may or may not be pensionable, isn't it true that even if the parties themselves all agree what they think it means and that it's pensionable, unless you get an agreement from the director or MSIRS board, it's still not binding on them, correct? They're not a party to the agreement. They're not sitting in, which is part of why I know the statute's now changed to give the 14 days beforehand. But even the language under the 22 version seems to imply that pretty directly, that unless you bring MSRS director involved into it so that you can get the right language so that you can then have it, you can't win, correct?
Well, it does present a huge problem for a pensioner like Mr. Henderson based on the 2022 version. And
But the point being is the MSRS is not bound by any decision, even if the employer and employee agree on what it means. Because of the point Judge E's making, has to be this language satisfaction that is consistent with A and prior determinations.
Well, again, it also has to be consistent with the law. And the law, because otherwise it's a clear error of law, which you can reverse de novo. If the language is clear on its face, as a matter of law, then the MSRS's decision was wrong as a matter of law. So what determination they made is wrong as a matter of law.
I guess my basic question is, given the way the statute's structured and the decision that we're reviewing, which is the board's decision, do we get to review the executive director's determination? Or are we just reviewing the board's determination that the executive director didn't determine that this was salary because the executive director looked at it? I mean, you see what I'm saying? Because the way this 13C says, if the executive director doesn't decide that the exception to legal settlements not being salary applies, then it's not salary. And the board made a decision, there's no sufficient evidence in the record. So which are we reviewing? Are we reviewing the board's decision, there's no sufficient evidence, or the executive director's legal determination? And you can go ahead and answer.
Thank you. I think you're reviewing both in the alternative. It is our position that the first question is a question of law, and you have the right to review a question of law. And if MSRS board is wrong as a matter of law, then that ends the discussion. If you don't think that it was clear as a matter of law, unambiguous as a matter of law, then we look at this whole question of whose intent was it. Eric, that is how this was tried. And it's our view that for all the reasons in my brief, that we had sufficient evidence, or there was insufficient evidence, that the intent was front pay.
Any other questions? All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Frank Langan here on behalf of the Minnesota State Retirement System, or MSRS. I want to begin my remarks by answering Judge Eade's question about what decision is being reviewed by this court today. And the answer is that you're reviewing the board's decision. The board's decision under 356.96 is the one that is appealable by a writ of certiorari. Now, that being said, the board's decision was whether to affirm or reverse the executive director's decision. So it is fair to say that they are sort of subsumed into one, but the ultimate issue here is the board's decision. There are three issues presented in the briefing for the court to consider today. The first we spent some time on already, but I'll discuss, is whether or not the settlement agreement was unambiguously for back pay. Now, that is reviewed de novo. The second issue is, if the settlement agreement was ambiguous, was there substantial evidence to support the MSRS board's decision? That second issue is not reviewed de novo. That's reviewed under the substantial evidence standard. And the correct interpretation of an ambiguous settlement agreement is a question of fact factual findings are entitled to deference under DOCMO and the other cases cited in our brief. And then there's the third ancillary alternative argument raised for the first time before this court about the $19,723. Starting with the issue of ambiguity, I'm going to respectfully disagree with Ms. McKinnon and her answer to Judge Sleater about the importance of the word alleged. The presence of the word alleged in the phrase alleged wage loss damages is significant because, as set forth in our briefing, there can be various types of wage loss damages. They can be future wage losses, past wage losses. Alleged doesn't specify which of those it is. Now, there's been some discussion of the fact that the settlement agreement also says alleged wage loss damages payable via W-2. However, as set forth in the IRS guidance at page 27 of our brief, both front pay and back pay are payable via W-2. So the presence of a W-2 does not resolve the ambiguity and is not per se dispositive. But to me, Your Honors, the great...
Can I ask you, part of the response that Ms. McKinnon made is that apparently that was language inserted, recommended to be inserted, and it ultimately was by the employee's attorney. What impact does that have on our analysis of that paragraph?
Your Honor, I think the fact that the employee's attorney took it upon himself to insert alleged but not insert past or something else to indicate past wages is greater indication of the ambiguity. Had the employee intended or had the parties intended and had had the meeting of the minds to have these be past wage loss damages, there are any number of adjectives that could have been inserted in place of or in addition to alleged but were not.
Such as what you just said. It just simply say alleged past wage loss.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Now, let me ask that then, kind of following up the questions we asked Ms. McKinnon. If the parties had done that, is the director, MSRS, obligated to agree that then that satisfies, is consistent with paragraph A and prior determinations?
Sure. So, had the parties done that, I suspect what would have happened here, hypothetically, is the same sequence of events of MSRS contacting the parties, asking both Mr. Henderson and the Met Council, okay, you say these are for past wage loss damages. What time period in the past are they supposed to cover? It's not simply a matter of jumping to the executive director deciding whether or not this is consistent with paragraph A when there's missing information. As we saw from the record in this case, MSRS will reach out to the parties and ask them for clarification. So taking the hypothetical a step further, suppose that the parties had said past wage loss damages, and suppose they had been able to specify a time period, a start and end date for the past wage loss period. Had MSRS's executive director then hypothetically said, this is still not salary or past wage loss damages, even though it looks similar to the settlement agreements that are in the record as record exhibits 22 to 24, which were accepted, then we'd be having a conversation today, I presume, about whether or not that was an arbitrary and capricious determination by the executive director, or whether the executive director exceeded her authority in making that determination, because it would be a determination contrary to the plain text. But we don't have that plain text here. What we have instead is a settlement agreement wherein Mr. Henderson received a payment of $160,000 and retired his employment from the Met Council. Had he rescinded, he would not have received that payment, but he would have been allowed to continue to work for an additional year subject to the terms of the employee interchange agreement. And that, Your Honors, is clear evidence of ambiguity, because if the parties intended for the settlement proceeds to represent back pay, there would be no purpose in having the alternative be an additional future year of work. The settlement agreement is ambiguous, which is why we then turn to these additional statements. We go outside the four corners of the documents to the conflicting statements offered by Mr. Henderson, by the Met Council, and by various other witnesses. And when the briefing is taken as a whole, Your Honors, what this appeal is a request for this court to reweigh the conflicting evidence in Mr. Henderson's favor, because there's no dispute that there's conflicting evidence in this record. Mr. Henderson asserts that this is unambiguously back pay. The Met Council asserts that this was future payment, that he was retiring a year early, and this is the salary he would have earned in that year. Ultimately, the MSRS board made a determination based largely on the ALJ recommendation, subject to exceptions, adopting both, and concluded that there was not a preponderance of the evidence to support a conclusion that this was back pay. I want to briefly address Henderson's claim that no one ever determined whether or not this agreement was ambiguous, because I don't think that's accurate. First of all, for the point that Judge Sleater made, if you look at page 6 of the board's memorandum, the first sentence of the first full paragraph expressly states that the board finds the settlement agreement ambiguous as to whether or not the $160,000 was intended for past wages. Past is italicized. The ALJ did not expressly write the sentence that the settlement agreement was unambiguous. However, the ALJ did spend a paragraph of her accompanying memorandum discussing the standard for contract interpretation and recognizing that parallel evidence is used only to evaluate ambiguous contracts. The ALJ then spent a couple of pages discussing parallel evidence, so there's a reasonable inference that the ALJ, who was aware that that would only be considered if the contract was ambiguous, at least implicitly found the contract ambiguous. Turning third to this issue of the $19,723 that the ALJ recommended be considered as back pay based on an alleged 4% increase that Henderson did not receive. Again, as set forth in our brief, no one prior to this proceeding has ever argued for this alternative conclusion. That argument was not presented to the board. It was a recommendation by the ALJ. And the gaping hole in the record on that third issue, Your Honors, is no one has ever explained what the other $140,000 would be. There's no evidence in the record that the board could have relied on to justify its decision to treat that $19,000 as salary. There's nothing in the ALJ's recommendation about what the balance of the settlement proceeds would represent. There are no arguments advanced.
Does the ALJ have to decide couldn't we imply that the ALJ would have determined that the remainder of the $160,000 would have been for things like promissory estoppel damages or, you know, what lost opportunity to work elsewhere, and that this is appropriately cabined with the calculation that the ALJ did, this being the $19,000.
Sure. I don't know that we could make that implicit assumption here just because of the wide, well, for two reasons. One, because of the wide range of possible other things $140,000 could be. And two, because MSRS's board, as the agency decision maker, has an obligation to explain its decision. Both parties have cited to In re Waters and the standard that the board must be able to show some rational connection of fact. If the board has no facts to rationally connect, then it can't make that determination. Moreover, what the board actually determined is that the $19,723 was based on a variety of assumptions made by the ALJ and not supported by the record that the MSRS board did not agree with.
Can I ask you, just to go back to some of the questions I asked Ms. McKinnon,
mm-hmm.
I understand why we need to look at, or I think I understand why we need to look at the settlement agreement and determine whether there's been any error in interpretation of it for purposes of subdivision 13A, and that's part of the definition in 13C. But there's also the prior determinations part. So to the extent that the do you understand subdivision 13C to allow the executive director to say, well, the amounts in this settlement agreement might be consistent with 13A, but it's not consistent with prior determinations that the board has made that this kind of settlement would qualify as salary. And therefore, I'm not going to find that there's an exception to the general statutory rule that this settlement is not salary. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm
saying? I understand your question, Judge Eade. I think the concern with that, well, so, could the plain text of Subdivision 13C, as written, academically be read in a way to suggest that even if something met the definition of Subdivision 13A, the executive director could still say no? As the subdivision is written, arguably, yes. However, if the executive director were actually to make a prior determination or to make a determination or have prior determinations that directly conflicted with Subdivision 13A, that would still present an issue as to whether or not MSRS was exceeding its statutory authority, to my mind, because it would raise an issue about, you know, the legislature, in crafting this definition, clearly intended for the starting point to be Subdivision 13A. Hmm. And so while the Subdivision 13C, I see your point, appears to, by its plain language, allow for contrary determinations, I'm not aware of any contrary determinations, and I think as a practical matter, any contrary determination would have been subject to a fairly direct legal challenge.
Doesn't that reading make prior determinations essentially surplusage in 13C? Because all of the prior determinations need to be consistent with 13A anyway, if I understand you right?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, for exactly the issue highlighted by this case. What we haven't talked about is Subdivision 13B, which sets forth all of the things that are clearly accepted from Subdivision 13C. The phrase front pay appears nowhere in Subdivision 13B, but the prior determinations of MSRS are to exclude front pay settlements from salary, consistent with the legislative intent behind 13B of avoiding one-time lump sum payments at the conclusion of employment from spiking someone's pension or someone's high five. So no, Your Honor, I don't think the prior determinations are rendered a surplusage, even if you use 13A as a touchstone, because every settlement agreement is different, even though maybe they shouldn't be, and even though, as we've seen from Exhibits 22 to 24, when parties connect with MSRS, they're able to fashion them in a way that fits those prior determinations and that definition. But again, I think the legislature recognized in 13C that some of this needs to be done on a case-by-case basis by the executive director. And that's the reason, as opposed to a surplusage.
Well, that's the reason for my question, because it seems like the analysis of whether or not it's consistent with 13A requires more of a de novo type review of the language of the settlement agreement that we've been talking about. But if it's the executive director saying this isn't salary because of prior determinations, that's a little more discretionary. Do you agree with that?
I agree that this is a sort of a two-part analysis, or there's two prongs, right? There's the consistent with 13A and consistent with prior determinations. And I agree that consistent with prior determinations has more of a gray area insofar as it's up to the executive director, as consistent with prior determinations the executive director has made. But as far as what's reviewed de novo versus what's not reviewed de novo for purposes of today's case, the issue is whether or not the settlement agreement was ambiguous is what's up for de novo review. That's what's being challenged here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can lower it with a button, too.
I think I'm okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The issue that I did not have a chance to address, but that my opposing counsel has raised, and I want to just make sure we get to that, is that if there is, should this court reverse the finding that the ALJ made that $19,000 should be given and that there was sufficient evidence to support the finding that Mr. Henderson had been deprived $19,000 that should have been, and that was part of the settlement that was salary. First of all, the argument that is made that this court should uphold the MSRS is that, well, it's clear that the ALJ's factual determination was based on unsupported suppositions, and that is actually not true. The ALJ was very specific in her findings, and she said, well, the evidence is that we had a salary of $152,500, and another person who had also gotten a salary, and the $152,500 was above what he used to make of $139,000, and that was because he was given a raise for acting out of class. And that another person was also given the acting out of class raise, and also this other person, Ms. Hauge, actually, H-A-U-G-E, was given a 4% increase, COLA increase in 2020. And that evidence was really clear. And she said, well, she, meaning the administrative law judge, well, this is an inequity here between peer employees, and the Met Council didn't give Mr. Henderson the 4% increase that was given to someone else. The government is kind of confusing. There were two things going on here, and the judge understood that. First, there was the acting out of class raise, which gave him a salary of $152,000. Then he should have received a 4% additional raise for the cost of living adjustment. And the only other argument that is made on this is that, well, there wasn't going to be a cost of living adjustment because the EIA said no cost of living adjustment. It didn't say that. What it said was this is what it's estimated to be. So the judge, the administrative law judge, actually did all the facts and the math. And that $19,000 should have been upheld.
That just depends on us agreeing that it was salary, right? I mean, if we disagree with...
Yes.
Right. Okay.
But then, you know, the other problem with my opponent's argument is, okay, so $160,000, none of that was salary. And the $19,000 that the administrative law judge clearly attract as salary wasn't salary. So then what was this money? Mr. Henderson was paid $160,000 for nothing? I mean, because bear in mind that this was a settlement, a mediation, and the value of the lost retiree health benefits was off the table. They said from the beginning, we aren't going to pay anything for that. And they said from the beginning, they meaning the Met Council, we're not going to pay anything for emotional distress damages. So what supports the Metropolitan Council providing a value of $160,000 if it wasn't salary or minimally $19,000 worth of salary? The real problem here is we just leave $160,000 just unaccounted for, that the government, you know, agency, the Metropolitan Council, is just paying for no reason.
I think they would argue it was for the release of all claims and to settle litigation, right?
Well, the release of all claims, but the release of all claims is, yes, he gets a release of all claims, but they can't pay for releasing claims that there's no basis for. So why would you pay $160,000 unless there was a reason for doing so? And in fact, what the testimony of Attorney Jayco was, you know, the promissory estoppel claim was a problem, and we knew that, and which is why they started with an opening offer of $75,000. So It's not nothing, and it shouldn't just disappear. Where a pension to a long-term, hardworking state employee is a really valuable piece of why we want hardworking state employees, and where that is going to go down because we omit some salary and there's some mistakes, that would be wrong, and it would be contrary to the pension value. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. We are taking the matter under advisement. We will issue an opinion in the statutory time frame.